Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Welcome to Deceptively Fast Podcast number 15. Please subscribe on iTunes or wherever else you might go so you can get this greatness where I'm joined by great people like Sean Pendergast every single week. Sean, how the hell are you?
I'm good. You have art now for your podcast, I saw.
I did. I got rid of the cat. I got rid of Snowy the cat.
And yeah, now it's just, new picture.
Now it's just me like throwing my hair back and looking kind of like, hey, that looks like a fun guy.
You know what you look like? You look like, you remember the... Remember the opening credits to 90210 back in the day?
Yeah.
Where they show like all the gang having a good time, and then they cut to like one of the stars sort of turning around in a really kind of casual, smarmy way.
Oh, really?
You look like you're at the very end of your turnaround.
I started.
In a 90210 credit.
I realized I started imagining the Friends opening scene. I guess they're all kind of similar.
They're kind of similar, but the 902, you got to watch it on YouTube. The 90210 opening scene has a very special way that they sort of turn around and they wind up at the very end with kind of the head cocked to the side and a smile.
What was your
like
era?
I feel like you should have the 90210 font across your chest saying, starring Seth Payne.
Were you junior high when 90210 came out, or were you high school?
No, I was college probably. It was late 80s, right?
Yeah.
I remember in the early 90s, I graduated college in 91. And after I graduated college, I went back home to Connecticut, and me and two buddies rented a condo, and that's where we all had jobs.
Yeah.
And we rented a really nice 3-bedroom condo, and we partied every weekend and stuff like that. But whatever night it was on, that was back when you had the 90210 Melrose Place double dip going on. And we were like three chicks, man. We'd like race to get home from work, mm-hmm. order pizza, and watch 90210 in Melrose Place.
That was before, I think that was before men admitted to watching Melrose Place.
Probably
did you kind of, you probably wouldn't have admitted it to your other buddies.
I didn't go into work the next day and like water cooler it about 90210 in Melrose Place, put it that way.
I feel like the same thing happened at an earlier age with masturbation. I think that there's an age at which every guy swears that, or at least it used to be this way. Now I'm sure it's a lot different, but like when you were 14, you would swear, hell no, I don't do it. And then all of a sudden, like when you're later in high school, everybody's kind of open about it.
We in junior high, I felt so bad for this kid. In seventh grade, there was this kid named Tom Flaherty.
Yeah.
And he was in his basement watching you got to keep in mind, this is like 1982. So he's in his basement watching like scrambled Cinemax.
Mm-hmm.
And he was doing it. He was masturbating. And like three of his buddies had come over to his house, and they walked around the side of the house. And you have to live in the East Coast to kind of know how this works. But there's windows into the basement in each house. And they look down in the window, and there he is just getting after it. And he had to move.
Because he was shamed as a guy that did something that everybody else was already doing.
They went and told everybody on Monday, like at school, like, oh my God, I saw Tom Flaherty masturbating. And meanwhile, we're all like... We all took special precautions after that with the blinds in our basement.
Yeah, that's like the worst in adolescent mob behavior where you just
different.
Admit to it.
It's different
nowadays.
Oh,
it's a lot different. I think, well, because everything's way more out in the open.
That's what I'm saying.
Like, but adult Baptists are like nodding their head right now thinking like, yep, that's a struggle.
Tom Flaherty should have been ostracized from Simsbury, Connecticut.
Sure, meanwhile, I got spotted at a liquor store by 8 other Baptists in a liquor store, and I'm the one that got shamed. What the hell?
Exactly.
So... Hard Knocks previews last night.
Yes.
Hard Knocks Cleveland. And I think this is going to be a good one. I think it's going to be a really good one because the hapless Cleveland Browns are somehow changing the culture despite the fact that Hugh Jackson is back for his third year as coach. I don't quite get this.
Yeah. I mean, new GM, but the same head coach. And it's funny, too. Like, Hard Knocks, it's... like last night, it's like we got reintroduced to some of our favorite characters. Like, oh, here's Greg Williams again. Remember, Greg Williams was on two seasons ago. And so it's like we've...
Oh, that's the Rams. He was with the Rams, and now he's back with...
He was part of Jeff Fisher's god-awful coaching staff that he had assembled. And now he's part of Hugh Jackson's god-awful coaching staff.
It's... And I think we'll do this. Well, let's just go through the different position groups. Okay. And we'll talk about the coaches and the front office. Because Greg Williams and his appearance, even though I knew Greg Williams... was the defensive coordinator of the Browns. I wasn't really thinking about them, and they did some good things last year, but I had forgotten that, yeah, he was going to be on here again. Greg Williams pops onto the screen, and I thanked Jesus for it. I'm like, oh, gosh, yeah, more Greg Williams. I need this guy claiming to a group of men that he turned down seven job offers to take that job with the Cleveland Browns. Is there anybody in that room? Because I know there are very few people outside the room that believe it. How many non-rookies do you think actually believed that claim?
Oh, very few. I need names, man. I need to know who those seven teams
were.
Were
there even seven defensive coordinator jobs open? Yeah, they were. There were a lot of coordinator changes. But to think that, like, half of the openings that were available offered Greg Williams a job, there's no way in hell Greg Williams got that many job offers.
That doesn't even happen with really, really good defensive coordinators. That would mean that he was the choice for seven teams. I feel like it's just a mathematical impossibility.
So Hugh Jackson is very humanized in this one. You started off, when you found out that Hard Knocks was going to be with the Cleveland Browns, my first thought was like, oh, there's going to be so many ripe opportunities to make fun of Hugh Jackson. Now, it's almost an impossibility because you learn over the last couple of weeks, he's lost his brother and his mother within the course of a couple weeks. And that's one of the big themes of this show is as they follow him getting the news and then also like weirdly breaking the news to his coaches while they're watching film. Like it seemed almost like mid-play, he kind of just randomly said, by the way, my mom died last night.
Yeah, I'm looking at my notes for that, Seth, and I'm like, Hugh Jackson breaks the news of his mom dying to his coaches as if their DoorDash order was late. Like that is the urgency level of the tidbit that he was giving them. Was like, okay, he's got his little red pointer out there and he's pointing at the screen. He goes, okay, here's Baker running that boot to the outside. Okay, and he hits his little cowboy clicker. He goes, by the way, my mom died last night. And they all like kind of turn around.
Yeah.
It almost felt like it was something that he was saying to make sure they were all paying attention. Yeah. But it was true.
Like, hey, by the way, like you'd slap something on the table.
Right. You know, like I've heard stories of this before. I don't think they do this anymore, but... I'll ask you, has this ever happened to you? Like where, just to make sure guys are paying attention, like coaches would drop like a picture of a nude chick in the middle of a sequence of plays.
Yeah, some guys will do that.
Make sure guys are awake or whatever.
Somebody did, I think John Pease would put in funny photos every now and then. He never went the porn route.
Yeah, but that's what it felt like. It felt like it was something, because they're all facing away from him. They're all facing the screen, and he's behind all of them. And that's what it felt like something he was just dropping in there just to see if they'd all turn around and go, holy crap. And then he breaks the news to them. They exchange 15 seconds worth of dialogue. And then he's like, okay, here's that read option play. Like, I mean, is that like how callous the whole thing is in the
NFL?
I
don't think that's what it is. I think that...
Now, he had a breakdown at the end of the show.
He had a breakdown at the end of the show. And I think, for me, it was almost like a psychological case study in compartmentalization.
Yes.
That... all this stuff happened right at the beginning of training camp. Yet in football, there's this culture of, look, you're the coach. You got to keep rolling. Players are the same way. You don't take a whole lot of time off for stuff like that, particularly when you're in the situation he's in. And Hugh Jackson's family understands that. You see the conversation he's having with his sister on the phone and everything. But I think that he was hurting, but that he also has to roll on and he doesn't want anybody's sympathy.
Yeah.
So that was... the one thing that I think John Dorsey did well in this episode, because John Dorsey, I've got a feeling that John Dorsey, the GM, I'm not going to end up liking John Dorsey.
He's a meathead.
He talks like his jaw is too heavy for his face. He's a meathead that wants to be intellectual, and he also keeps bringing in the dregs of society to this team, and yet acts somehow, people are somehow surprised when the dregs of society continue acting like the dregs of society.
He also wears the same thing every day in a job position where you shouldn't be wearing the same thing every day.
I don't know about that. That's like kind of Steve Jobsian. Steve Jobs would say,
"Oh, did he wear the same thing every day?"
Yeah. So you don't get decision fatigue. Okay. There's a concept that all these little decisions you have to make throughout the day fatigue you and wear on you. So one of the things you can do to avoid decision fatigue is just be as routine as possible. That includes wearing the same thing every day.
Okay. You know, I've interviewed Tillman Fertitta a few times on my national show and on the local show here. I need to ask him about that because Tillman Fertitta wears the same thing every day.
He wears like a mock turtleneck.
I don't know if it's a mock turtleneck, but it's like he wears like a black t-shirt underneath like a black, like, it looks like kind of like a nice suede windbreaker type jacket, not like a sport coat, although he does wear a sport coat sometimes. But he basically wears
it's like
all
a
black
uniform. It's,
t-shirt underneath a coat with black pants. I wonder if he subscribes to that. That's a really good example of somebody who's been successful subscribing to
that. And it's big in Silicon Valley. So there's the decision fatigue aspect of it. And then if you go on further, like with Tillman Fertitta, I think there's that psychological impression you make on people by having a look and kind of a brand.
For sure.
That becomes you. Like, that's this guy I identify. Like, I look at him almost like an icon more than a person. And maybe that gives you a little bit of authority. I don't know if John Dorsey's going that deep into it. I've tried. I'm way too lazy. I'm too lazy to wear the same thing every day because you have to commit to an actual look.
You do. And my fear is that I'm not going to like doing it, and then I'm going to have a closet full of one outfit that I'm never. For me, it's a fiscal decision. Like, I don't want to invest all the money
into one outfit. Right, to actually have nice clothes in all that one outfit.
I don't have the closet space either.
I got to have
Amy
like five different
our
things. Okay, so the other big thing, and this will morph into the wide receiver talk.
Yeah.
Hugh Jackson, at the beginning of the episode, is breaking it to various people that, hey, Josh Gordon, our wayward wide receiver who's been suspended for, was it 58 games over the last 4 years?
They said the stat on the show last night. It was over the possible 48 games that he could have played from 2015 through 2017, he's only played in 5 games.
Right.
And I think they were at the end of last year.
So, for those of you that don't know, Josh Gordon, you find out right before training camp this year that he's not going to be there at training camp, that he's got to take care of his health, he's got to take care of some personal issues. And you're like, all right. And the Browns coaches or the Browns PR people are acting like, well, this is routine, it's not that big a deal. It was cool to watch Hugh Jackson break it to his staff, and everybody knowing they're on camera, you can just tell, you can see everybody holding back and being like, oh, there's so many questions I want to ask, but I got to wait until we like meet at the Denny's after this or something, because I know we can't do it right here. But then you get to watch the sausage get made.
Yeah.
Like, you get to watch the PR guy, Peter Jean-Baptiste, who looks more like a PR guy than any PR person I've ever seen. Like, he came out of Central Casting.
Yep.
Kind of figure out, okay, how are we going to spin this? Like, how are we going to present this to the media? Which is weird because you're also being filmed and seeing how you're going to present this.
I wonder if that's a guy who just forgot he was being filmed. You know what I mean? Like, he just got caught up in the moment. Because what that tells me is they do that a lot with stories like this. That's what that tells me, is that it's, you know, fairly routine. And the Browns, of all the teams in the NFL, have probably had to deal with more situations like this. I mean, hell, they were dealing with one yesterday.
Corey
Coleman's replacement gets caught with weed in his car. Like,
Antonio Callaway, he's one of these guys that I'm talking about. He's got a history. Like, he fell to the third round because he's a magnificent talent, but nobody felt like they could trust to have him on his team. And you saw a few shots in this episode of his back, like him not practicing.
Yeah.
And then you find out that he had gotten arrested for weed possession.
Yeah, the sense I get, Seth, is probably like having to, you have a team that's gone 1-15 and 0-16 the last 2 years. They've had plenty of peccadilloes going on off of the field. They've had constant turnover on the roster and in the front office and head coach. And I don't know how long this PR guy's been with the organization, but I feel like if you've been with that team for any amount of time over the last few years, that sitting here figuring out how we're going to go tell this story and still not be a laughingstock is probably something that these guys have to do on a fairly routine basis.
Right.
You know, like, for that dude, what was his name again?
John, hold on, I wrote it down.
Like, was part of his hyphenated last name.
It's Peter Jean-Baptiste.
Okay.
He sounds like an apostle.
He does. I feel like for him, like, that was just Wednesday. You know what I mean? Like, okay, well, Josh Gordon's not coming in.
This is how we're going to, like, they have a five-minute meeting every morning. Like, all right, well, this is how we're going to spin this.
Yeah, I feel like it was no big deal.
This is what leads me to this. So Jarvis Landry, who a month ago was touting the Cleveland Browns wide receiver room as, like, one of the most magnificent and talented ever to exist,
yeah,
gives a speech where he calls out half the guys in the room and calls them bitches.
Who, by bitches! The way, like, half of them were sitting there, like, This is what struck me about that scene, and if people watched it, the scene that you're talking about, it was a phenomenal speech.
It was a really good speech.
You know, as far as players go, like, for a player to get up in the middle of that and get up and do that, you could sense like Jarvis Landry is with the Browns and he got traded there, but he signed a long term deal. And a guy who signs a long-term deal there, and he's building a house. You know, we saw that. Like, he's planning
big old house. I couldn't tell in that development whether he has all that property or if he's, like, the first house in the development.
I'm not sure either. I was trying to figure that out, too. He has a really nice house. We know that. And he's planning. He said it. I'm planning on being here for the long haul. But, like, he obviously doesn't. He's all about this culture change we talked about earlier in the podcast as well.
Not really known as a leader in Miami, but now he's in a new place.
No, and it's kind of funny. Like, because he gets up there and he starts talking. And, like, I feel like most of the time when a guy gets up there that's new to the team and starts talking like that, he can talk like that if he's come from, like, the Patriots
right.
or the Steelers. Like, hey, man, this is how we did it in Miami when we went 5-11 last year. That said, what struck me about that scene wasn't Landry. It was that the fact that the guys who were still in the room, like, who looked, he's right. Like, that room looked like it had no energy.
Yeah.
It was downtrodden. Guys with their hoodies on pulled over their heads. Like, nobody moved. Nobody sat up. That was an alarming thing to me.
And did he call them bitches?
He said,
you're acting like bitches and a few other things. Yeah, there were 33 F-bombs we had to delete out when we played that on the radio.
You counted.
He made one really good point, which was that, hey, when guys sit out, the rest of us have to take extra reps.
That's
and
right.
You make us more susceptible to injury. That used to frustrate the hell out of me when guys that had minor injuries were sitting out. But then, and you know, I'm glad you picked up on this too. So everybody, including myself, are like, yeah, Jarvis Landry, way to call those guys out. You get to the end of the show where Joe Sheehan, a guy I know who's one of the head athletic trainers up there in Cleveland, names the guys that are going to sit out
yes.
in practice for preventative reasons, that they're holding these guys out of practice because of an injury history, because I don't know if they have the biometric data or whatever, but they're just doing it for preventative reasons. And then the coaches are left to talk about it, and you find out, oh, wait a second. A lot of those Browns receivers that Jarvis Landry was calling out were probably held out of practice. Like, it wasn't their decision. And for one, Todd Haley has an issue with the whole practice of holding the guys out, and he lets Hugh Jackson know about it. Hugh Jackson says, hey, I'm the boss. I'm going to do it.
Yeah.
Todd Haley looks like he might have had a fifth of whiskey the night before.
I feel like, boy, Todd Haley's aged a lot in the last few years, by the way.
That's some hard living.
It is. It is. That's a guy who should not have a beard.
Yeah.
As somebody whose beard, when I grow it out, grows gray, that's why I don't grow it anymore, because I look like 15 years old.
Makes you look weathered.
I used to have, when I moved back here in 2007, I had a goatee, but the whole bottom of it on my chin was gray. When I shaved that, like, 3 years after I moved here, I looked like 10 years younger. So, anyway, sidebar. But I feel like Todd Haley wishes that they still had two-a-days that started at, like, 6:30 in the morning.
He definitely. He's like, the classic, like Marv Levy said, there's a lot of guys being tough with other men's bodies.
Yeah.
I feel like Greg Williams, and that's what's so interesting about that dynamic. Hugh Jackson is explaining, hey, I used to be this way, but we got to keep these guys healthy.
Yeah.
And you can just see Todd Haley and Greg Williams chafing against that.
Yeah.
And trying to do the right thing and be good soldiers and not argue with the boss.
Did you... And I know you didn't go to West Virginia this year, but you went last year, and I don't think Bill O'Brien has changed his MO all that drastically in a year. And I know it's only 1 hour, and they probably pull the parts that make for the best TV, but I don't know that I've ever seen the Texans have an intra-squad scrimmage in the time that we've been covering them. I know they've scrimmaged other teams, you know, they've worked out against
contact.
Other teams. A full contact one. I say all this to ask you, did that look like a lot more intense and physical practice than anything we've seen from the Texans over the last few years?
I would have to go back and watch the 2015 series, because the Texans...
Good point.
The Texans have done full-speed goal line.
Yes, they have.
Because sometimes on goal line, it's almost impossible to practice really well without doing full speed. It's harder to simulate because everything's so fast and so immediate.
Right.
So I don't know. I'd have to go back and watch 2015 and see whether it was actually all that physical, because I don't know... there's only so much you can get away with in today's NFL.
And it may be just me coming off a week where I was there, where there was one padded practice the entire week. Like, it was not a physical week of practice for the Texans.
I said this morning, I feel bad for players and coaches now because, look, they don't want to make it sound like it's easy or anything, but people keep asking the questions about how, well, when you what's it like in the grind of camp? And these guys don't know how to answer the question because there's no grind. Like, this isn't me being like Joe old school.
No.
I thought the way they used to do it was really dumb.
Yeah.
I thought that it was just way too much. And it's just the fact of the matter is now there's not nearly as much contact. They practice once a day. They're getting much more rest than they used to. And like the notion that somehow these guys are ground down, players and coaches don't even try to sell that anymore.
Right.
And they just, people ask them these questions and they don't know how to respond to them.
And I almost feel bad as somebody who covers the game, covers the team, has a radio show. I almost feel bad criticizing players when there's poor tackling because they don't tackle anymore. They don't bring guys to the ground. They don't hit. They don't do anything.
See, I disagree just because I think with the focus that there is now on actually coaching tackling, I think some teams have gotten better. And I think, like, if you look at the Seahawks when they've been good on defense, when they've been really good on defense, they're very sure tacklers. I thought the Texans up until last year been really good tacklers.
Yeah, 2016, they were great.
You would be amazed at how little instruction there was in actual tackling back when guys... Because I think a lot of coaches always assumed, like, well, thud them up, and then in the game you'll tackle them. And I never got any real good instruction on tackling, like genuinely good quality instruction on tackling the entire time I played football until I was in my fourth or fifth year in the NFL.
Okay.
And there was a special teams coach, Frank Gant Sr., who was awesome at it. And I all of a sudden went from being an average tackler to like a really good tackler.
Yeah, yeah.
Because he taught the technique and it was all with bags and it was all technique and all of that. And now you see a lot of teams, you know, the Seahawks have a tackling coach that works on these things and does these drills and you do rugby style tackling that you can practice without pads on. So it's never an excuse anymore. And
right.
I like when I see a coach complaining about how you can't tackle in practice, to me, I hear, wow, you're not working that hard.
Yeah.
Like, you're really not. You're not trying.
Interesting.
Like, you've just given up on trying to coach these guys. And same thing with offensive line. When I hear coaches bitching about how, hey, these guys come out of college, they don't have any skills. Well, that's great. You've got an opportunity then. Because if you're an actually good coach and all these guys are coming out of college and they're not as skilled as the offensive lineman used to be, that means you can have an advantage if
you coach them well.
Stop bitching.
Yep.
There's
absolutely
nothing that drives me crazier than coaches who will tell their players not to bitch, and then just they bitch constantly.
Yes.
And then I buried the lead. We should always probably start off every show about any football-related thing as quarterbacks.
Yes.
Baker Mayfield, obviously, number one overall surprise selection of the Cleveland Browns. I'm excited about Baker Mayfield. You see him, they open up the show showing Nick Chubb, the running back, second rounder, in the airport, and he's largely anonymous. Other than the fact that there are cameras trained on him, people don't know who the hell he is. Nobody's approaching him.
How fortuitous or serendipitous was it that he had dudes walking up to him like, hey, who are you?
Right, yeah.
I mean, almost made me wonder if they were plants.
Yeah.
You know, like it was almost too good.
At the very least, like, here's this yoked dude that cameras are on and people are asking
him
why.
Must be somebody.
Whereas Baker Mayfield's walking through the airport and obviously everybody's asking him for autographs and taking selfies and everything.
And the funny thing is, Chubb, he's not a nobody.
No, not at all.
Chubb's
a big deal.
He dealt with some injuries at Georgia, but he was a good player when he was healthy at Georgia. I think they picked him in the second round.
Right.
So that's a funny thing. He's like, he's not some obscure undrafted free agent. Like, he played in the national championship game last year.
I was excited to see a little bit more of Nick Chubb. I thought we were going to see some of that. And then you realize, okay, without pads on much and without a game, you're not going to see much of him at all.
Yeah.
And I think they used him mostly just to show the difference in attention between him and Baker Mayfield.
Totally.
So they show Baker Mayfield, they show him interacting with Tyrod Taylor, who's the presumptive starter for at least week one, and those guys are getting along great. And then they show the RV, and this is what I still don't get, how Drew Stanton, who is the veteran guy in the room on the Cleveland Browns.
Yeah.
But he can't be that much older than Tyrod Taylor, I don't think. Tyrod doesn't have as many accrued seasons. But Drew Stanton's been in the league for a while. Drew Stanton is acting Like he's this guy that's been an old grizzled vet in the league and that he's been through the wars and everything. He tells Baker Mayfield, hey, listen, rookie, you're going to get an RV for us. Drew Stanton doesn't have the resume to demand an RV from his rookie.
He doesn't, but how old do you think he is?
I bet he's 32. He's been in the league for at least 10 years, hasn't he?
He's 34.
34?
He was a second round pick in 2007. That was the Jamarcus Russell, Brady Quinn draft.
Okay. And how many games has he started?
I will tell you. I don't have how many games he started, but he's thrown 20 touchdowns and 24 picks.
That's not bad. Yeah, but he's thrown 20 touchdowns.
Yeah.
So anyway,
he won a few games for the Cardinals a couple of years ago.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah. Until the playoffs came around, and then it got.
Well, and then Ryan Lindley was starting by
that
then.
That was Lindley in the playoffs. You're right. Yeah. So,
but you're right. Stanton
demands an RV.
Stanton was out kicking his own coverage. You know what I mean? He was out kicking his own image.
But shoot, I guess you got a number one overall pick. You might as well go for it. So this RV, this is going to be one of the stars, or he should be one of the stars of training camp, is this Brogan Roback character, fourth-string quarterback.
I had to rewind because I missed the graphic that said he was a quarterback.
Yeah.
I had to rewind to see who he was. I'm like, holy crap, this is a camp body here.
Oh, he's like a combination of the Damn Daniel kid and every 80s coming-of-age teen movie villain.
Yes.
Like the bad kid and Karate Kid and everything. And he seems like he's got personality. He's in charge of stocking the RV, and he's got way more personality than Baker Mayfield
or
Tyrod Taylor,
yes.
Drew Stanton, who we barely see anything of. This kid's got to make it through the final cuts, you know, at least up until the final cut, just so we can watch his journey.
If I'm a Browns fan, I was a little depressed at Baker Mayfield's lack of pizzazz in that first episode.
Yeah,
his lack of, to put it bluntly, and this played out in the scene where he had to sing. Am I allowed to curse on here?
Yeah, go for it. I had Paul Gallant on yesterday.
He has no bullshit.
Yeah.
Baker Mayfield has no... Now, his game, he's a really good improviser on the field, but I felt like when they... You know, when you get put... You're the number one overall pick, and they stick you in front of the room, and you're a quarterback, you got to show a little personality, man.
Uh-huh.
And you can't be singing Country Roads, Take Me Home by John Denver, much as I like that song, and much as we admittedly played it as soon as we crossed over the West Virginia border last week. You got to come up with a better song. You got to come up with a song that connects to more of the room.
And he, as far as you can tell from the way they cut it, he just kind of launched in right at the refrain. I'll say this to defend him.
Yeah, you
got to
start with the opening lyrics, man.
When you're a rookie, you always hear these stories about guys having to get up and sing their fight songs. And this happened to me. I was the first guy they called up. For some reason, I don't know why,
but
because we had like an old grizzled vet in the defensive line meeting room. That it was Jeff Logman, and I knew my college fight song. I was all ready to sing that. They got up. I gave my name. You give whatever else other embarrassing information they want to have. And then they tell you to, like, I'm anticipating them saying, hey, sing your fight song. They're like, no. They said sing your fight song. So I started down my fight song, and within like 3 seconds, James Stewart, the running back, says, oh, hell no. Give us something different. And, like, when you're up in a room, like, and you're already intimidated, you're a rookie on this group of men, like these football players, and somebody tells you to sing a song on command.
Yeah.
It's like one of the most deer in the headlight moments ever. The only thing I come up with, and this was even worse than Country Roads, Come Monday by Jimmy Buffett. I started singing Come Monday, which is an awful song.
It's an awful song, but at that point, you're a goofy rookie defensive lineman.
Yeah.
You know, you're probably kind of heavy. That's kind of a drinking song. You know, well, Come Monday's a little mellow. It would have been, you know, maybe boat drinks or something would have been better. But point being, he's the quarterback, man. You got to be ready for that moment.
Be ready for the moment. I wonder, he's kind of stuck in that position too, where he's trying to be cool and have like the right amount of confidence, but at the same time, he is a backup right now. He's a rookie. David Carr got out of singing when he got here. And I honestly think at least part of the problem with the Texans in the first couple years was that Chris Palmer and the staff were so concerned with propping up David Carr's ego that it went overboard, yeah, and that David never really got the really tough love that he probably needed. And he's, yeah, talked about how he didn't quite understand how hard he had to prepare. I think there was, not that I wanted him to get hazed or, you know, give him pink bellies or anything, but I think there was maybe a little bit of that tough love and kind of, yeah, knowing where you stand in the organization that you got to earn something.
Too much kid gloves.
Yeah, that he didn't quite get.
Yeah.
So I like seeing that Baker Mayfield at least got up and
at
sang.
At least he got up. At least he sang. You could see the guys in the room that at least they were focused on with the camera shaking their heads. Now, if it were me, I immediately, as I'm watching this, I'm going, dude, I Want It That Way by the Backstreet Boys. That's what you got to go with, because I feel like that connects across multiple socio-racial,
right,
age barriers.
Different genres of music.
It's gotten a little bit of a revival from the State Farm commercial with Trevor Ariza and Chris Paul. Mm-hmm. It's a song that's very easy to see. People love the refrain to that song. That is my go-to jukebox hijack song.
Oh, really?
When Amy and I go out to places that have jukeboxes you can control with your phone, I pay whatever credits I need to cut in front of everybody to play I Want It That Way by the Backstreet Boys, just to see the reaction in the room. And literally, I've done this, and for 50 straight times, ultimately, half the room, you can see their heads start to bob.
You feel like
and
it unites everybody.
And when the refrain comes, tell me, yeah, why. Yeah, absolutely.
Even against their better instincts, yeah, even the guys that don't want to like it.
I feel like, especially if he knew the lyrics leading up to it, because it would have gotten the guys sort of slowly into it, and people would have been anticipating the refrain. He started with the refrain. I feel like he could have even gotten away with Country Roads, Take Me Home, if he had just started with the actual lyrics to the song, because you got to build up
well,
to
I was
refrain.
Wondering, though,
the refrain's like the climax.
There's a good chance here, Paul, that we'll get found out right now as middle-aged lame dudes, because I was thinking there might be a really good chance that somebody had sampled that song recently, and there might be a rap song out there
like there's
that has Country Roads,
Take Me Home, yeah, by Drake featuring Future,
yeah,
or something,
yeah,
like that.
So I think there is that possibility.
Yeah,
this is the Reality Review, so we got to hit Very Cavallari,
yes,
real quick.
Very but before we do, oh, okay, your grade on the first episode
grade
of Hard Knocks.
I would say a B plus, and I would give it an A minus, other than that it's not his fault, obviously, but I can't quite make fun of Hugh Jackson the way I wanted to. That was one of the things I anticipated, was you start off the episode with him jumping in Lake Erie.
Yeah.
I had all kinds of tweets planned, and then immediately in the next episode, he's finding out his mom died.
Yeah, I came away liking Hugh Jackson, and I never thought that would be the case. I give it an A-, because a lot of my grade with Hard Knocks has to do with how much I'm looking forward to the next episode.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of looking forward, especially because we got a guy who got traded, which they've teased already with Corey Coleman, and a dude who got pinched for weed, which they haven't teased
and
yet.
They've got, oh boy, Josh Gordon coming back, Baker Mayfield's first snaps. I think it's going to end up being a really good one.
A-.
I don't know about the Browns this year. I'm a little bit nervous about them.
Yeah.
Very Cavallari, you and I have missed a couple of episodes here.
Yeah.
But for those of you who aren't watching, and I'm really growing towards recommending that you not watch it, other than like watch clips of Jay Cutler on YouTube.
Amen.
Yeah, it's just too much. There's too much of a gap between, I think, the stuff that women would typically like and the stuff that guys would typically like. It's not they haven't done the Jerry Maguire brilliance of molding those two things together.
They have not. If anything, it's grown apart.
Yeah.
You know, in this last episode, it really grew apart because Cavallari's at the Oscars. And there's Jay Cutler back home with, you know, four of his friends eating steaks at the kitchen table. Yeah, I'm going to watch it all the way through because I'm committed to it now.
I like Kristen, too. I like her. I respect her.
I like her a lot. I think she's a good businesswoman. I think the one thing she might be really bad at, and I've said this before with you, Seth, unfortunately, the one thing she might be really bad at is the thing that my philosophy has always been counts for 80% of your grade as a manager or a business owner is hiring.
Yeah.
I think there's a good chance she's terrible at sniffing out talent for people who run her business.
She's also running a retail store for the first time. I think her online stuff is going to be all she has to do, though, is license. Like,
yeah,
she just needs to lend her name, keep doing what she's doing,
yeah,
have her name out there, license the Uncommon James name, and let everybody. When I found out and realized a couple episodes ago that those women are handling all these administrative things, but also that they're the shipping department.
Yeah, the web orders, yeah.
Like, they're handling the web orders?
Yeah.
Like, wait a second. This
She'll
is not streamlined the way things. Your PR person. Your web development person over there, or what is Shannon?
She's the social media director.
Shouldn't also be in charge
packaging.
That's the last person I would want in charge of shipping stuff out.
They're all tied for last.
So this is an actual quote.
Yeah.
I'm going to ask you a question after I read this quote, too. So Kristen Cavallari, who's going off to host the red carpet at the Oscars, right?
The Oscars,
has this quote about what it's like leaving Jay. Yep. We've been together for so long. Honestly, it's kind of nice to have a minute to myself. Sean, how long have they been married?
Like, how long? Like
5 years.
5 years. I was going to say
we've
5 years
because
our oldest is
so long. And it's nice to have a final break like, every now and then.
Hey, there's a lot of runway left, babe.
Every other episode I see, you're going out and socializing without him. What the hell are you talking about?
So true.
We've been together so long.
So true.
But she seems genuinely entertained by Jay. One of the big things that made headlines here was that Jay Cutler had read an article in GQ about how to go down on a girl. How to perform cunnilingus, which sounds way dirtier than...
I was going to say, cunnilingus an acceptable
cunnilingus
replacement?
Is the dirtiest sounding clinical name
Are
for a sex act.
Are we allowed to say that on the air?
Cunnilingus?
Yeah.
I would imagine.
I'm going to have to run that by Ryan.
We're not allowed to talk about secretions or insertion.
Right.
Or,
this is just
a description of something. So
some act.
So she says he apparently read some article on GQ about how to go down on a girl. It's been a game changer. Yeah. So then she adds, yeah, like every time. So... that's the quote. When I watched it, what I interpret that is like she has an orgasm every time.
Me too.
That he goes down her. So this writer says that the way he interpreted it was just so we all know the frequency with which Jay Cutler performs oral sex.
That was his analysis of the every time.
Yeah,
quote.
Yeah. There's no way in hell that's what she meant. She meant every single time.
Every single time she has an orgasm. Jay Cutler is now the most efficient orgasm. He is everything as a lover that he wasn't as a quarterback.
He's got a QB rating of like 113,
He's got
114.
An OBR rating, orgasm rating, you know, of whatever the highest score is you can get.
With no
158.3.
Again, he's shown more commitment to this than anything he ever did while he was playing, and it's somewhat dismaying.
I feel like he may have spent more time reading that GQ article than he did reading the Miami Dolphins playbook in 2017.
I really get the sense from these episodes that, wow, he really phoned it in Miami last year. Like, it's almost even an afterthought. There are a couple times where he has to remind her that he was even in Miami last year.
She called it a vacation. At the end of the episode, where the two of them, Kristen and Jay, are in the kitchen, and she's running the idea by Jay of bringing her whole staff to a beach somewhere before they open the store. Great idea, by the way. Way to reward your staff before they've done anything. And Jay doesn't like that idea. He said that's a money loser. But she runs this idea by him, and she goes, well, you were on a vacation in Miami for 5 months. And then he gives her the money sign, like rubbing his fingers together.
Almost like he didn't realize it was an audio and visual recording. He was like, I'm going to do the money sign, and then the cameras won't pick it up.
It's a bad week. It's a bad week of reality TV if you're a Dolphin fan, because you watched your quarterback from last year basically just say he was only there to cash in a $10 million check, and you're watching the only guy who probably gave a shit give a speech to the Cleveland Browns in Hard Knocks before you're like, God... like, this is a bad week, man. A reminder of all the bad things that have happened to our team over the last year.
The worst thing for the Dolphins that could happen
is Brock Osweiler's on their team, too.
If Jarvis Landry actually ends up getting like 13, 14, 15 yards per reception, if he actually becomes
instead
a downfield threat somehow,
right.
And all that Miami people have been telling themselves for these last few years is like, well, that's just what he does. That's what he's limited in. It turns out that, like, wait a second, Adam Gase might not be an actual genius. That'd be bad for Miami Dolphins.
Bad football team.
We've got more stuff to talk about with that, but we'll save it. We'll save it till next week. The one highlight of the show really was that Jay had a guy's night out, and I found that Jay's gay friend from Vanderbilt and his bolo tie friend wearing the flannel shirt need to have their own spinoff. Those guys had chemistry. They were funny because he had like ultra masculine dude next to Jay's gay friend, and they were like they had like a playful banter going where they were just clearly from different. It was an odd couple type.
The best was the gay friend trying to figure out the mechanics of how a vasectomy works.
Right.
Like, he thought the vas deferens got, like, pulled through the
urethra
pee hole.
Somehow. Yeah. And he started off the whole conversation by, like, kind of talking down to people, like, you realize they're not actually cutting your balls off.
Yeah, right.
He's like, saying that to Jay, who's had a vasectomy.
I'm like, dude, I know you're gay, but you have a penis. Like, you have the same anatomy that Jay has. Like, you know, it shouldn't be a mystery as to how the whole thing is put together.
All right, man. Lot to look forward to in the coming week. At some point, too. Okay. At some point, Hard Knocks will be over, and we'll talk a little bit more about football and pop culture and stuff. But I'm sucked into this thing now.
Yeah.
Thanks, buddy.
Hi, bud.
So that, of course, was Sean Pendergast. You can follow him on Twitter @SeanT Pendergast. I'm finishing this up in my own house, so that's why the echo sounds a little bit different. I want to encourage all of you that are enjoying the show to please subscribe to it on iTunes. And then also, if you feel like it, leave a 5-star rating. That helps a whole lot with the rankings, with my bosses. Everybody gets happy when Seth gets 5-star rankings. And I'm really excited about what we've got coming up over the next few weeks as football starts to roll into form and we get through these preseason games. I'm going to add a few more regular guests, Paul Gallant, Sean Pendergast, a few people from the world of football as regular guests from the national media. So I'm really looking forward to that and helping this thing grow. We'll delve into more non-football topics as we kind of figure out what I'm doing every single day of every single week. But please, keep listening. Give me your feedback. Seth@deceptivelyfast.com is probably the best way to keep it fresh in my mind so I will see it before the podcast and take any of your tips or recommendations, ideas for guests, whatever it might be. Again, subscribe on iTunes, and please, if you feel moved to, give a 5-star rating and a description. That would just be absolutely awesome. I will see you all soon.
You could spend the weekend doing the same old whatever, or you could conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.